Hello, cyclocross friends, and welcome to episode 140 of Cyclocross Radio. On today's show, in the basement, it's Taylor Jones joining me. Hey, Taylor.
Hey, Bill. How are you?
I'm doing well. It's been a minute since you've been... Well, it hasn't been a minute since you've been in my basement. That's probably only been like a couple days.
That's true.
but since we've actually recorded something, so this is good.
Been several minutes, yeah.
Yeah.
Good to be back.
Yeah, so I wanted to just spend this time chatting about a couple different things, you know, starting in the world of cyclocross, since, you know, cross is coming. Now that we've had our last race, so it's officially cross is coming season.
Yeah, you can, once you're done, you know, unpacking your bike from the last race,
yeah,
then that's just the first cleaning, getting ready for the next season.
Well, yeah. I'm at the point now, you know, you can see it over there, that I haven't fully unpacked from cyclocross worlds, just in preparation for the beginning of mountain bike season.
Yeah.
So I figure most of that stuff can just stay in there.
You got to be careful though, because they may, if you're going to California, they might not want any of that Danish mud.
That's true.
You might bring some...
That's true.
It's all material diseases, etc.
I
watch out for the sniffer dogs.
I was honestly concerned, because I know it would have been like, I would not have been let into Australia with my boots from Louisville.
I believe that,
because they were not like pristine,
yeah,
and like you cannot bring a speck of dirt into that country.
Yeah.
They would have confiscated my boots, would have been quarantined, my cyclocross boots. But yeah, so wanted to chat a little bit, just to, you know, tie up some loose ends on the cyclocross season, and then, you know, have a little conversation, since it's mountain bike season is just around the corner, you know, and this is the crazy year, 2019. We've got 2020 Tokyo Olympics, and every 4 years, the mountain bike on the very top level goes from racing for your trade team to basically racing for yourself and fighting for a spot on the Olympics. That's the most important thing happening in mountain biking.
Yeah, I think it's always really interesting to see how these dynamics play out. I think the thing that sticks out in most people's mind is, you know, going back, gosh, I mean, decade and a half now, and seeing, you know, how in the U.S. our mountain bikers are trying to qualify for Athens 2004.
Right.
I think that's kind of what's seared in people's minds of,
yeah,
how insane and complex the selection criteria are. And regardless of how good of a rider you may be, the way the tiered criteria are set up by the IOC, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's something that I think, you know, we'll dig a little bit into it, but it's something I think we're going to revisit as it goes along. And we had this whole controversy in cyclocross over selection criteria and, you know, equality between the men's teams and the women's teams, and the, how do you treat juniors and U23 riders versus elite riders. And it's a little different here, mm-hmm, because it's basically we're not really talking about who's getting left out, but it's like, especially for the US, who's going to be the one person to go.
And right,
such a
right,
smaller sample of yeah, people that
it's almost as if you're not fighting everyone else to climb to the top of the mountain. Everyone's already standing at the top, and we're just going to find out who the last person,
yeah, for sure,
standing is.
Yeah, yeah. But before we even get to that, I think the biggest stories from the end of cyclocross are the end of two significant eras, and that would be the retirement. Really, you know, we were talking about Lillis before. Really, the quick announcements for both these riders, for Kevin Powles and also for Helen Wyman. I think both of these announcements kind of we figured they would be coming eventually, but they kind of sort of out of thin air at late in the season.
Yeah, it was, I mean, I think for both of them, it was somewhat, maybe more so for Kevin Powles than for Helen Wyman, a bit anticlimactic in that, you know, he'd had, I think by what most people would consider a very solid season, but there weren't necessarily any huge standout results. So, but, you know, looking back at the trajectory of his career, that was not necessarily out of place for him. So I don't think you can say that it was a really pedestrian season that forced him or forced his hand. I can't imagine that he wouldn't have been able to get a contract if he wanted to for next year, for a team, for series, etc. But you've got to think that not being selected again for world championships, I'm sure that played a role in his decision. You know, considering that he's somebody who's medaled at Worlds in previous years.
Yeah.
I think that had to be a factor there. I think for Helen, it was really interesting because it seemed like this year, and a lot of the data bears this out, that, I mean, women's cyclocross on the professional level in Europe, both at the elite and the U23 level, and even the junior level, was really just on a huge upswing. So much more TV time, you know, bigger media share in Belgium and Holland, so much more positive press, so many positive things happening on that front. And she was someone who was obviously really at the forefront and pushing for that, not just this year, but her whole career. So, you know, maybe it's a sign that says, hey, I've done as much as I can as a full-time racer to push things to where they are. And we'll see what her full-time, you know, gig ends up being. But if she were to say, I want to do even more, and I feel like I can better do that if I'm not also trying to train and race, that wouldn't surprise me. And I think she would be one of the best ambassadors you could imagine.
Oh, absolutely. And you look at it and, you know, you think, is she, you know, her decision to retire, but you look at her track record, you know, winning the national championship 2006 to 2012, coming back 2014, 2015. At that point, you're thinking, okay, maybe she's slowing down a little, but then just last year, 2018, winning another national championship. So still on the top of her game, still getting big wins. But I think that you are right in that as accomplished and as one of the greatest women cyclocross racers that we've seen, what she has done off of the bike in the sport has almost, if not, I would say maybe even eclipsed that, and has been a more important accomplishment. And I don't think that you can get there if you're not a successful rider. And that gave her the clout to do the things that she was able to do off the bike.
Yeah, I don't think that there's anyone, even if they were a top rider, male or female, especially not being Belgian or Dutch, could have come in and said, you know what, I'm going to launch an initiative and we're going to put on a junior women's race for the first time ever in Belgium at one of these big race weekends. I mean, the fact that she has lived in Europe, you know, well, on the continent, spent so much time in Belgium, has decade plus of those connections. That's the only way you can make that happen.
But let's go even so, because this is something that you and I are really closely connected to. Let's look at where a lot of this started, and it's not in Europe, but it's in the Mid-Atlantic.
Yeah.
And she is somebody who Helen Wyman was almost a local racer for us for many years. You know, she would come up, she would race Charm City, she would race Nittany, she'd race, I think she was here even for like Gloucester, mm-hmm. and stay for a month. And
there were a number of years when she brought a lot of other Europeans here.
Yeah.
I mean, you have Tim Van Nuffel, you had, you know, top French riders, male, female, coming and racing in the Mid-Atlantic. You know, if it weren't for someone like her, and this was in the years before everyone was going everywhere to poach UCI points. So sure, you could come here and you maybe have a little bit lower level of competition for an early season C2, but I don't think that happens unless you have someone like Helen who's building that network and, you know, making those connections happen. And, you know, the lasting impact that we have here in the Mid-Atlantic even is that several years ago when Charm City and Baltimore redesigned their course, I mean, who was the person who was the course designer?
Yeah, it was Jay Lazar, was also Steph Wyman.
Steph Wyman.
Yeah, helping out for sure and making a lot of the changes that made it into one of these sort of prototypical and classic European style courses. But what I was getting at with Helen coming over here, her relationship with Charm City Cycling, her relationship with Chris Auer and 2020 Cycling, the shop that is now closed, but I think one of the most meaningful things that they did with Helen as a co-conspirator in this was that this little shop in Baltimore with Helen as a partner, went to Europe, went to Belgium, went to, was it before the Dave Ave? Was it, was it already the Dave Ave, or what was before? That was the predecessor of that. I can't remember that it was Copenberg Cross was the Costa race. And they had the 2020 Cycling Classic, which is what the women's race was called. It was the first Belgian race, probably the first European race at that elite level that offered equal prize money for men and women. And that was, you know, with the help and the funding of people in Baltimore and through 2020 Cycling, but Helen had a huge part in that. And I think that that really got the ball rolling. And that from that, we saw all C2s have equal payment. From that, we saw Trek going forward and offering equal pay for a World Cup that has now forced the UCI to change the rules and make all races equal. You know, a couple of years we are going to be at the World Cup level down to the C1s down to everything is going to be equal across the board. And I think that really starts with that Copenberg Cross race.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I you know, I can't disagree at all. I mean, I think that it really shows you the commitment to making the sport better. And I think that's what, and I think that's one of the big reasons that Helen Wyman had such a huge fan base here in the US, because I think that especially the sport of cyclocross, everyone who participates, they love the pro riders, they follow that, but it's such a participatory sport that the people who are invested in the sport are the people who are racing, and they're the ones who make it what it is. It's not, you know, we don't have 10, 20, 30,000 people paying to come watch races in this country, but the community that does exist here, they are very invested in the sport and they're very selfless when it comes to promoting things and making them better. And I think that that connection, that's a big part of that connection that Helen helped build and make here in the US, and has taken that and translated it in Europe, where you oftentimes did not really have that.
Yeah. And I think that that goes even to, we can look at the other things that I think we talk about as being big issues as far as that equality goes. You look at race times and that, and she, by being on the cyclocross commission, has had say in getting women's race times to a place that is more acceptable. You know, we still have some issues. It's supposed to be between 40 and 50 minutes. I believe the new rule now that's going to go into effect, maybe not next season, maybe season after that, is going to be 50-minute races for women, which is exceptional. That's to the point that we should be. I mean, I know it's an unpopular opinion. I'd love to see the men at 50 minutes too. I think that that would be perfect for both men and women to be racing equal times, and that's a good amount of time. But to get out of this spot where, you know, it has to be between 40 and 50, which would always lean towards the 40 side, and even, you know, dipping under that, is another step in the right direction. And even, you know, not to say that Helen had a part of this, but even I think that what you were talking about, and I really do think that the US and North America does a great job of shining a light on it, much to the chagrin of probably a lot of the old guard in Belgium, is like getting the women out of the 7 a.m. race, you know, in Europe before the juniors raced, and or the 8 a.m. race, and putting them into prime time. And then the result of that is what we saw this year, where you look at the TV ratings and the women were catching the men, you know, and everybody's gonna say, well, it's because Vanderpool was just killing everybody and those weren't competitive races. But so what? There was an alternative there that was just as more exciting of equal athletic prowess to watch. That mm-hmm. was a sport at the highest level. And that's kind of all we wanted, was for that opportunity to be there.
Yeah, that's, you know, for sure, 100%. And I think that you also see the other downstream impacts of that are, you know, greater opportunities and more exposure for U23 women. A lot of this has been a groundswell, you know, pushing towards, we'll see a junior women's world championship, which is something that hasn't.
Yeah, and hopefully what we can see, and especially with those, and there's a lot of hand-wringing now that TV ratings are just down across the board, so that's going to be less revenue. And I understand that, but I think that's something that happens in sport. There's always going to be that ebb and flow. But with this, it's always a question, and I, you know, that you have to, nobody's going to give you money out of altruism. It has to be earned, and I think that value is now earned. So hopefully what happens now is we start to see, you know, bigger contracts for women, so that they can, if they want to be a cyclocross racer, they can be a cyclocross racer, and they can do that and don't have to do every other discipline. I love it that they do that there are a lot of women out there that are able to be successful in multiple disciplines, but it should be by choice, not by necessity.
Yeah. I mean, I think the other part of it too is that if it pushes us into a realm where potential sponsors or advertisers see that perhaps, you know, the TV audience is shifting for whatever reason, and then they want to have more eyes on their product, and that encourages more sponsors to think about the return. Maybe you get a better return on investment for sponsoring a women's team or individual athletes, you know, whatever causes those things to happen. I don't think anybody is going to say that that's necessarily a bad thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, if those are downstream impacts, then that's great. But you know, I think that, I think the big thing with the retirement of Helen Wyman, and she's been really open and clear about saying this, is that she's not going to be racing anymore, but she's not going away.
Right.
And I think that's really important to the sport. You know, very easily top athletes who've been at the top of their game for a long time, you know, if they decided tomorrow, hey, I'm done, I just want to walk away, I want a different life, especially in cycling, that's not uncommon. And I don't think anybody would really fault people for making that decision. But at the same time, I think it's to be lauded when someone like Helen says, look, I'm not going to be racing, but I'm still going to be involved in the sport.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's good to see. And I, you know, it's something that, again, personally, because we're trying to find a way for our development team to maybe make their way and be a part of that. Yeah. But that Helen 100 is just such a huge thing. And to be able to even, you know, if it happens or if it doesn't happen, just to have it in our, you know, as sort of management of this team, but also for the riders, that this is a real possibility. Yep. that junior women, you know, have that opportunity, and that's something really cool to look forward to, that is a real possibility.
Yeah. And just to look at Helen as a role model.
Yeah.
And someone who they can, you know, they can aspire to what she has achieved, not just in sport as an athlete on the race course, but in general with, you know, the way she has always comported herself, with, you know, being available for the media, the way that she's always done a really good job promoting her sponsors. You know, those I think are all really important lessons that any athlete, especially a professional athlete in cycling, can take away, because it's such a, even on a global scale, it's such a small community that it really is, it's all about the networking and the connections and you know, it's really, if you burn one bridge, there's a lot more that are probably going to be burned down because of it.
Yep.
And I think it's really important to recognize that. And I think looking back over the course of Helen Wyman's career, you can see that she's someone who very much understood that and is, you know, I think if you want to aspire to have a career like her, I don't think you could pick someone better to look up to.
Yep. Absolutely. All right. Let's move on to the other retirement. Kevin Powell's.
Yeah.
If anything, going out the right way.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's, you can't really ask for a better ending, last race of the season, racing, you know, we can say Wout wasn't there, Vanderpool's not there, but still winning the race in Uusmaala, beating Tone Aerts, beating Tom Mason, beating Lars Vanderhaar, beating Lauren Swick. So yeah, a nice, definitely a nice last bow and last ovation for Kevin Powell. That's the way to do it. If you're going to retire, that's the way to do it.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that it shows you that he wasn't somebody who, you know, was going to just wait until his career was really in a downward spiral to go out. You know, it's good to step away when you still have the ability to pull those good results, to win a race, to be a protagonist. And I think there's a lot to be said for that. And I think that looking back over the course of his career, I think a lot of people will probably say, you know, if he'd only been 10 years earlier or 10 years later, I mean, you probably would look at his palmares and it would be very different, because he overlapped with so many riders who are really the greats, the icons, of the sport of cyclocross. And I think that's good, but you know, you look at his result sheet, and if that's the only way you want to measure someone, that's perhaps unfortunate then.
Yeah, I mean, I think a good way of looking at the generations that he spanned is if you just look at the world championships that he was involved with. You know, and here's something, even before I get to that, we joke about Kevin's place, how just him and that third step on the podium, and how it seemed like, you know, he's the kind of guy would be a slow starter and then out of nowhere would appear, and then he looked like he won the race, and just race after race, it seemed like he ended up in third. And you go back and you go, could it really have been that much? And just looking through his palmares, it's like you look at like 2015-16, third in Zonhoven, third in Gewehr, third in Wallonne, third in Namur. You get the next year, he's third in GP Eric de Vlaamic, third at Degum, third in Namur. And then we look at the world championships. This is a guy who was world championship as a junior, world champion as U23, then third in 2011, third in 2012, third in 2014, third in 2016, and third in 2017. And of course, the one that's missing where he didn't make the podium is the one that we all thought he was going to win in Louisville in 2013. You know, if not for that mechanical.
Yeah, it's truly impressive. I mean, there's nothing else you can really say. I mean, I think there are plenty of,
but I think
there's plenty of lesser riders that you would probably, maybe because they won fewer races, but they won bigger races, that maybe stick out in people's mind. But from a sheer consistency perspective, I mean, that's why you can look and you can say, okay, he was a top level cyclocross pro for 15, 16 years and only raced with two teams.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Which is also pretty crazy to think about.
And getting back to my original point, if you look at him, he was racing, like we go back to those third places in World Championship 2011. So he's racing with Stibar and Sven Nys and Niels Albert, and then with Niels Albert and Rob Peters, and then his teammate Klaas Van Tornout. So it's really that old. I mean, for us, I think just because of when we got in the sport and started following, that was sort of the golden age, I think, for us with riders, you know, with the Wellens and Niels Albert and that whole crew. But then he's still racing at that level against guys like Lars Vanderhaar and Matthew Vanderpool and Wout Van Aert and Michael Van Tornout. And, you know, yeah, you look at these other older guys who start to fade away and retire, and yet he's still there, just plugging along and still being able to pull down those big, you know, podium. The kind of placements that we look at anybody from North America and we go, oh my God, if we had somebody doing that, he'd be a national hero on the men's side. Of course, we do on the women's side, but on the men's side, that would be just something we haven't seen, you know, since Jonathan Page left.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's... I mean, I think it's almost incomparable if you look at his result sheet and the impact that he had, because he was always there, he was always a protagonist. I suspect that, you know, if you asked any of, you know, across essentially two generations of cyclocross pros, I mean, I don't think that anybody would say that you could write him off on any particular race. I mean, I think if you were, you know, if you wanted to go and see the guy at the course side with the, you know, with the odds scribbled on the chalkboard, I mean, and you laid down a fat bet on him on most any race, I don't think they would laugh at you.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and he's definitely somebody who's going to be missed. I mean, you know, they talk about his demeanor, quiet, unassuming guy. I think that, you know, you can go back there are articles out of there if he was, you know, and I don't know. I'm not going to diagnose the guy, but there was like talk like Asperger's or something like that. But I think that he was mainly just a pretty introspective, quiet guy.
Yeah, and I thought about this, you know, again, not to like overanalyze, but I've thought about this too. And I think that part of it is, if we weren't in an age of, you know, immediate consumption of all types of media right in your face, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, whatever, you know, and that's how so many people are essentially interacting with their favorite riders or whatever sports teams that they're fans of, etc. So if those folks aren't creating content continually, they kind of fall off your radar.
Right.
And so I think that that's unfortunate, because, you know, just because he wasn't somebody who was, you know, really opening a window into what's going on in his life outside of when you see him on TV at the races, doesn't make him any less of a person or an athlete.
And he also fell into that thing, you know, it's kind of funny, because you cannot win. So we're going to give Sonny Kant and Wout Van Aert a hard time because they show too much emotion, but possibly negative emotion when they don't win, you know, the Wout pout, whatever else. And yet we're also going to give Kevin Powell's a hard time because he doesn't show enough emotion. Mm-hmm. It's like, what is the accepted level of social media emotiveness?
I don't know. If I knew the answer to that, yeah,
I think it's fun to watch these guys race these women, and that we should probably leave it like that. And when we get these people who want to be in the public eye and want to be, you know, characters, we'll embrace it. We're all for it. But I'm not gonna like give, you know, put a strike next to somebody's name because they're not like that. I think that's kind of ridiculous.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think that's very much, I mean, you mentioned Jonathan Page, and I think he's somebody very much kind of in that same vein, that, you know, face to face, in person, you know, very nice guy, willing to give you whatever time you want to, you know, talk with him. But again, not, you know, a prolific tweeter or Instagram poster or whatever. But you know, it's like you said, I mean, these guys and the women, they're there to be athletes and get results. And maybe that's a change now. You know, maybe the change now in 2019 is that a lot of these athletes, because of maybe the demands of their sponsors, you know, maybe that's part of their contract. Like, hey, you have to have to have this kind of public persona, but I think it's probably not for everybody.
It's not for everybody, and I don't think that that's a unreasonable ask. in today's world for being a professional, but I think that also you need to, you know, everybody's got their strengths and their weaknesses.
Yeah.
And you know, it's something that could, yeah. I mean, I don't know.
I think there's on the course. Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think there's really something to be said for somebody who just shows up, gets the job done, pulls in good results, is not out there in the media making excuses if the results don't come. I think there's really something to be said for that. And I think that that's definitely to be respected.
And also, this isn't to say, it's not like the guy was a jerk. If you wanted to talk to Powell's, he talked to you, you know. It's just he wasn't gonna, that wasn't his gig.
Yeah.
All right. Should we move on to some mountain biking? Sure. We got anything else for cyclocross we need to?
No, we can move on to the sport where everyone embraces people with outsized personalities. And the sport that it seems to encourage it.
It does. There's definitely some of that. But before we do that, we have an old friend that has returned to the cyclocross radio and also the wide angle podium fold, and that's Health IQ. And we're really happy to have them back as a sponsor of not only this show, but of the Wide Angle Podium Podcast Network. And if you're new to the show, or you haven't heard us talk about Health IQ for a while, I can tell you that Health IQ promotes a health-conscious lifestyle through financial rewards. They are a life insurance company, and they celebrate the health-conscious. They are looking at all kinds of athletes. For us, mainly, it's cyclists. Although Taylor, I'm running now, so you know that could also be something that they could look at. They can look at my Strava files for running.
They were probably
Taylor's more of an off the grid kind of guy. So if he wanted to do this, he would actually have to start, you know, but you do what you do have a power meter. So you do have files somewhere that you
have it. I haven't yet installed it on my bike, but I do have it.
Okay. So,
and I have a Garmin now that you gave me a power cable for it.
Perfect.
So I'm getting there slowly.
Yeah. And that's the kind of thing that Health IQ wants to see, because they want healthy individuals to get behind and to sell you life insurance, because you're a better risk for them. And since you are a better risk, they can give you savings on life insurance. And how they do that is a couple different ways. Once it's Health IQ, so they're going to test your high IQ on a healthy lifestyle and sports. They have a cycling test. I aced the cycling test when I took it. And there's some good, like, arcane racing knowledge that you have to know on this test. So it's not just, you know, easy stuff. You gotta know your cycling history to do well. But I know that all of you,
you have to know how to fold up a spare sew-up and put it under your saddle.
Or how to get it around your shoulders just right. But not smoking the cigarette. They would frown upon that part. That's gonna raise your risk. But what they do, that you can take this test, you can become eligible. That's basically how you apply. That's part of the application process. Taking that quiz, it's kind of fun. And then after that, I talked about the power meters and Strava and that kind of stuff, because they will look at that. If you send them everybody that you're doing your Zwift races now, those are the type of things that you can show to Health IQ, and that will get you an even lower rate. So, you know, it's something that being healthy is something that is going to help you get a lower rate. They also take into consideration things like LDL, HDL ratio, with triglyceride HDL ratio for low carb, paleo dieters. So they know that. They don't look at that as a red flag. They know that healthy lifestyles incorporate some of this. So we don't look like traditional people, yet we're probably healthier than a lot of them. You know, looking, you know, not necessarily looking at BMI, but looking at waist to hip ratio, so it was a better predictor of cardiovascular disease, all this kind of stuff. So if life insurance is something that, if you are, you know, out of college and starting to get into your 30s, maybe thinking about having a family, this is the kind of responsible thing that you're doing it. You're basically doing it for your loved ones. You're doing it for your family. It's insurance. It is exactly what it does. It's an insurance plan, and this is the best way to do it. So long story that I'm going to try to bring in for a landing here is I want you to go to healthiq.com/WAP, click on that, fill out the information, take the quiz, and then get yourself set up with some life insurance. Even if you're just curious about it, it helps us. If you just take a look there, click on the link, fill out the information, and that's going to help us continue to do what we do. It's going to help you to protect your family in the future. So healthiq.com/WAP. All right. Mountain biking.
Here we go.
It's been a while since I did that. I got to get it down to a... That was the long version that we can always send people back to. And then
it helps when you start stretching the tubulars.
Yeah.
Couple days in advance,
sitting them on the rim,
but they have to have been aged in your basement for
for sure in the cellar,
7 to 12 years maybe.
Yeah. The only real takeaway that I think worth anything that I took from the Lance Armstrong diaries was the the Belgian guy with the tubulars in the cellar.
It's pretty impressive.
Yeah. That were there for many years.
That's what I tell myself I'm doing with all the ones I have that I've just been too lazy to glue.
Have you started calling your basement a cellar though?
No, there's no outdoor access entrance. Okay. I think that's the key.
All right.
Yeah.
So here's the thing about mountain biking. First off, anything, there's so much is happened since last year to this year, just as far as shuffling of teams. Yep. On the pro side, we saw, I think the big ones we saw, Yolanda Neff going to Trek Factory Racing, Kate Courtney going to Scott. Those are probably your two marquee team changes. I think on the downhill side, probably Aaron Gwynn going to Intense, and just starting up that whole team.
Atherton's setting up their own team.
Setting up Atherton Racing, yep. Trek Factory Racing now getting into a HQ-based team. So no longer, working with the Athertons, but having their own team, bringing back guys like Charlie Harrison, keeping Cade, mm-hmm. So that'll be a really interesting squad as well. But who else, who on the men's side are we looking at as far as big transfers for mountain bike? Fluky, left Thomas, right?
Yep.
So that was one.
That's one. You see there's still... despite the fact that BMC really pulled back on most fronts, they do still have a presence with a few sponsored Swiss riders. It seems like the Cannondale team got a little bit stronger. Maxime Marot, he should have a good team this year. They had a good run of results last year. You see Gerhard Kirschbaumer, the Italian. He switched teams, which I think he's not necessarily a household name, but
he's good. End of last season, I'm not sure what his results were necessary, but he definitely was a name that was popping up there, even to the point that he was going to be somebody at World. Where did he end up in Worlds? Because wasn't he up there fighting it out there for a while as well?
Yeah, for sure. And I think you see...
Well, of course, Cannondale also, Avancini.
Yeah.
A huge year last year, mm-hmm. ending up second.
You also saw, you talked about, especially in relation to Kate Courtney, the big move on most fronts was Specialized, kind of really pulling back, both on the men's and the women's side.
Yeah, Klahavi starting his own program, Klahavi, right? Basically a privateer.
Yeah, privateer, still riding a Specialized, but I it's not necessarily like factory support. I guess it's more like the Czech distributor. Don't know. So, that's, I think, quite interesting. You kind of wonder where those other, where they're repurposing those kind of sponsorship dollars and those resources.
Another change just, from a guy that I had worked with in the past, Sergio Montecan, going mm-hmm. from Trek over to Cross. So that's mm-hmm. another change just from that Spanish side. But even more than that, something that I wanted to chat with you about, especially as we said that, you know, as much as teams are important right now, everybody is concentrating on the Olympics, is I'm looking at the final standings, and I think what we saw with the last Olympics, the Rio Olympics, it was this huge fight between all of the Swiss on who was going to get, and most likely they're the top team, so they'll get three spots, who was going to get those three spots. And when you had looked 4 years ago at the standings, it was like white crosses up and down the top 10. And that's no longer the case.
Not anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is a good thing.
I think so.
It's you know, we talked about Avancini. There's a guy from Brazil who's second in the world, you know, an Italian who you mentioned, Kirschbaum. That name, the German name for the Italian is never not going to throw me off with him. Gerhard Kirschbaum, or the Italian. But yeah, in third, and then Maxime Marot in French. And then I think it's going to be really, really interesting to see how this plays out. I mean, you have to imagine that the Swiss are fighting for two spots. I mean, Schroeder's basically a guarantee.
You got to think, but I think also you look at the nation rankings, and I think anybody probably could have guessed that Switzerland was the top nation, but I don't think many people would guess. If you said, hey, who's second? People would probably say, oh, I don't know, France, maybe Spain. I don't think anybody would say Italy.
Yeah.
And so I think that'll be interesting because, you know, Luca Bredo, he had a really solid season last year with Gerhard Kirschbaumer. I think they certainly have, and that's just on the men's side.
Yeah, and here's the other thing that people have to understand, how it's going to go down, that they're going to decide how many riders go from each country. The first and second ranked countries get three riders.
Right.
Third through eighth get two riders.
Two riders, yeah.
And then, or third through seventh, and then eighth, basically all the way down.
Just get one.
Get one rider. But not all the way down, because there's only, I think, 37 total riders for men and women.
Yeah, I believe that's correct.
Really, really small field. And so the dynamic is, you have riders who are racing basically against their countrymen to try to get better finishes than them so that they can be eligible for the Olympics. But then you also have pressure from the federation for the team as a whole to do well and race every race to make sure that, you know, look, Italy is not a shoe-in.
No, not at all.
France is only 100 points back.
Yeah.
So that extra spot for the Olympics is also on the line. And that's sort of the secondary battle that's going on here. And that's just, those are the things that just make this so crazy. You look on the women's side, U.S. right now is sitting pretty. They got three spots. They're second in the world, you know, pretty much on the back of, you know, like Kate Courtney winning worlds and things like that. But they also, you know, they had some great finish. Short track also.
They're actually third.
Oh, they're third? They were.
Canada second.
Oh, that changed. I swear to you that I thought that they were second. So, okay. Well, they can fight. So right now they have two with the possibility of moving up to third.
Yeah, but you got to go down, you know, okay, so Kate Courtney.
Yeah.
I mean, you got to go down to Chloe Woodruff.
Yeah.
19th ranking to find, you know, the next American. And then below that, it's another, you know, 10 spots down to Aaron Huck. So you see that it's definitely, you know, it's tenuous, right? That overall ranking, the nation ranking, it's really on the back of, you know, Kate Courtney.
Yeah.
And all it takes is one bad race, two bad races.
So what do you think that, that, so Kate Courtney is your reigning world champion. She'll go into 2019 as the world champion, not guaranteed a spot on the Olympic team. That didn't do it for her.
It's crazy.
So for the U.S., the selection, basically there are two test events. It's going to be Worlds this year, and then the first round, I think it's Novo Mesto. First round of the 2020 season.
Yeah.
Part of it is like, okay, that's fine. That's much closer to the Olympics. That's,
right.
That's, you want to be, to have who's going to be the strongest rider at that point. But man, it's just kind of like, you almost look at it and go, well, you won your world championship at the wrong time. You should
have. Yeah, I mean, we were talking a little bit before we started recording, and I was saying the thing that this makes me think about is not just the, you know, 2004 kind of saga of who was going to make the Olympic team, but it also, you know, even prior to that, when in the U.S., especially on the road, I mean, they had an Olympic trials road race.
Right.
You know, and it's just thinking about like all the different ways that USAC has tried to set up some kind of selection criteria to name a team for Worlds, you know, across all different disciplines. I mean, obviously you can't have uniform rules across all disciplines because they're so different, but yeah, it does seem that it's, I hate to use the word unfair, but that you have basically two chances and that's it.
So how is it different than, so, and I know it is, but just playing devil's advocate, for swimming, you have Olympic trials and you basically have to qualify and then you get on the team. You sort of got to prove it against, is it just that we can't?
I guess, and I will readily admit that I'm fairly ignorant on other sports in terms
sure.
of, but I think for swimming just jumps out in my mind as something that, I mean, for at least in the US, Olympic trials are like a known in quantity. And like, that is a thing that you strive for in swimming, is to qualify for Olympic trials or to peak your season for Olympic trials, or your build up over 2 or 3 years is towards Olympic trials. Hard to say you can do that when, you know, for this, when the selection criteria drop, you know, now roughly, and then you have what, 18 months or less. It's not really how the cycling seasons are structured either. It's not
right.
structured around that.
Right.
I think that's what makes the timing too of when, you know, when in the year, in the calendar year, the Olympics will happen, because it's also moved up a little, you know, from, or pushed back. I can't remember. I think it moved to like September or something, or I feel like the Olympic window is maybe slightly different in Tokyo than what it usually is.
Okay. Yeah.
I could be wrong, but you know, it just seems like that's not the time of year you're peaking for, say, world championships.
Right.
As a mountain biker. So you kind of have to change.
Yeah. So if it's middle of the summer, then world championships are usually end of summer.
Right. So maybe if you're talking about July,
yeah,
then maybe that's the time you're taking a rest if you're peaking for Worlds in September. I don't know.
So if we dive a little into the U.S. Requirements. So they are calling this tryouts in the U.S. Athlete guide. There are tryout events. That's going to be 2019 World Championships in Mount St. Anne, which is cool. If any, you know, for all of us in North America, we should all be heading up to, you know, with apologies to my friends at GoCross. We should be heading up to Mount St. Anne. This is the thing that kills me. Just to go on a quick aside here, we have World Championships the same weekend as Go Cross, an event that for us from a team aspect is very important. So this is a very difficult thing there that I think we're going to have some.
So if we draw straws and you get the short straw, then yeah, you'll be in Roanoke. And I'll the rest be in Roanoke. Of us make sure we have our passports ready.
That's it. You'll be going to Canada. And then
we'll bring you some poutine back.
Well, and then we have even another, you have your first UCI C1 cyclocross race of the year in Rochester, which is another race that I've, been associated with for several years and will probably not miss again. It's okay, I'm just dropping things on the floor. That's the same date as the World Cup in snowshoe,
mm-hmm,
which is a huge bummer for me.
Mm-hmm.
It's like I'm really split there, but I think I'm already committed to Rochester, so I'll be missing that. I guess.
So do you now feel do you feel the same way as all the people who complain about
the road
cross season encroaching on the road?
Yeah, yeah. No, I'm trying to figure out if it's mountain biking going too long or cyclocross starting too early.
Maybe road season's just at the wrong time of year.
Maybe if we just got rid of road season, then everything else could just sort of spread out. We could keep the classics.
Sure.
Yeah.
I have a lot of thoughts on this. That's for a different podcast. I think sadly in many regions in the US you could probably make an argument that road racing might be going away. So maybe those people who share that perspective might get their wish, Bill.
I will say that I was impressed and I applauded I know you're not on the list, but in the Mabra list when the because I thought it was like promoting an upcoming race, but a thank you for all the people who raced at William & Mary last weekend. I thought that was impressive. That's good.
I saw that they're
on the road
February. As much as things change, the one thing that never changes from, it's probably been 10 years since I've done that race, it's always cold and rainy and miserable.
Yeah.
Some things never change.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
I will say my biggest road cycling victory in Mabra, it was figuring out how to unsubscribe from the listserv.
You podiumed at that.
Yeah.
It was not easy either.
No.
Because that wasn't it. Yeah.
No.
Well,
I failed many times before I succeeded. Yeah. But no, I mean, to go back.
Yeah.
Sorry. We'll turn the pages back.
Yep.
I think that it's definitely, and this also goes to what we were talking about earlier with multi-discipline riders, especially on the women's side with cyclocross. I mean, you see it same with mountain biking, so then you have to think about how you deal with these conflicting priorities and conflicting seasons. And even for some riders, they might race for different teams.
Yeah.
Different trade teams have different sponsors. So then there's the push and pull on that front too.
The only saving grace is going to be if we can convince I don't think we have to convince when I was going to say Neff, but I have a feeling if she's already there racing in snowshoe, she's probably just going to be racing Trek Cup as well. Can we just start that rumor now? It kind of makes sense. It's our team race and she's going to be in the US.
Mm-hmm.
So, all right. Yolanda Neff will be at Trek World Cup.
I do look forward to all the Europeans.
Along with Nino Scherder.
Yeah. I look forward to the Europeans coming to the East Coast and realizing how close to absolutely nothing snowshoe is.
Oh, and that's not even like we talk about, what are the Europeans going to think about Iowa and this and that? And my whole argument there was it's no different than Belgium. Like, and I think that like the Telenefidea team and all that, they just fit in great in Iowa. They had no problem with it. It's going to be different when you are on top of a mountain, which again, all of these elite mountain bikers are used to, and there is nothing open on top of that mountain.
And there's cell signal.
No cell signal, no sketchy internet, and you better have packed food for the week.
So. And Bill can also tell you, make sure you fill up your gas tank on the way into town.
Good Lord.
So,
yeah.
Those of us on the East Coast, especially if you've been around and been involved in mountain biking for a while, Snowshoe is an iconic venue.
Yes.
Not just because it's been the site of U.S. National Championships the past few years.
Angels are going to come down and there's going to, the basement is going to light up when you mention the next thing that used to happen there.
Yeah. What, the Norman National? I think it's an iconic venue, and I think, I don't know what went into making that happen as a round of the World Cup, but I think that's great. And I think those are the kind of things that, I think that's good for everyone in the sport, because it's really easy to say, okay, this is the 6, 8, whatever rounds of the World Cup, and we go to the same places every year and we go in the same order, or this year, we'll go to Val d'Isol before we go to Andorra instead of the other way around, mm-hmm. whatever. I think it's nice to have some variety. How many Euros will stick around, and
but at least it's, I think the Snowshoe, as much as I'm bummed about how the schedule played out, the Snowshoe was a really smart move, because in years past people could skip Mount St. Anne and get away with it, mm-hmm. and they'd still be okay. But most of the time, if you look at how the World Cup season breaks down for cross country, it's in 2 week sections,
blocks. Yeah.
So you have one race, you have a Val d'Isol, and then everybody goes to Andorra, and that's one block. Mm-hmm. You have a Albstadt, and then everybody goes to La Bresse or wherever. There's always two races right next to each other, and everybody travels from one to the other. You're basically, it's a little odd that, it's more like cyclocross season now that you're having a big race after World Championships, but it's a little odd to have a World Cup after World Champs, but that they did it both in the U.S. is more incentive for riders to come out. And now, you're probably going to get riders who are coming out just for Snowshoe, because mm-hmm. they're not going to necessarily make the World Championship team. So that's a little different too.
Yeah, that will be, I think that is an interesting dynamic and something that you don't often see. And I think that the timing, the timing is right. I don't know that you would have a Snowshoe World Cup if we weren't in the run-up to the Olympics,
right?
In terms of having an event, because I think it would be very easy for plenty of European based pros to say, we're not going to make that trip, but in a period of time when the nation ranking is really important, the individual point ranking is really important, it makes the case for that race to be something approaching mandatory for everyone.
Yeah. And just for my pipe dream of everybody staying and racing cyclocross, they are right after it. So you go,
yeah,
World Championships, Snowshoe World Cup, next weekend is Jingle Cross, next weekend is Trek.
You're already heading west.
That's right.
Already going more west. You got to drive through West Virginia to get there anyway.
So you know what this means? We're going to see Vanderpool back in the country. Be forced to come to the U.S. again. 100%.
You think so?
He's going to race. He's not going to miss Mountain Bike World.
That's true.
I think we'll see how the season goes. But
that guy never takes a rest.
Yeah, but this is perfect for him, because that was his big complaint, and legitimate or not, I think it's a fine, especially for him, since he can get away with it and still mm-hmm. win everything, is that it wasn't a long enough time in the U.S. for him to come out. And he was, his thing was he was resting after mountain bike season, but this is easy. He's just like taper down into those first two World Cups.
Spend a month in the U.S.
Yeah.
Or North America.
You can go to Utah and hang out at Sagan's home, since they're buddies now.
Yeah. Who? Now, the one thing I did want to say, I thought it was really, really interesting and really cool to see, and maybe it's because of the influence of Kate Courtney, but to see the whole Scott team in the U.S.
In the U.S., yeah.
Training. I mean, not for like a weekend. I mean, they were there in out in Arizona for a couple weeks.
Yeah.
I thought that was really...
You have to think, I mean, just really cool. Scott, but also you look at their connections, especially with that part of the country, and you have Richie, mm-hmm. you have Oakley, mm-hmm. you know, so I think that it was, it's there, that was probably an incentive to do it, but it's also, it's this, that, I mean, Arizona is becoming this global place for training. You know, we're seeing it with these houses starting out and these just mm-hmm. sort of facilities. I mean, Emily Batty pretty much lives mm-hmm. there now. And, you know, I see like a lot of the other top mountain bikers for the U.S. and North America all in Arizona. And it's really flipped over. It used to be, I used to think of it just as a place where all the roadies right. went to train. But now, yeah, it's definitely becoming the place to go. It's like our little Girona in the U.S.
Yeah. They all copied Todd Wells.
Yeah. Yeah.
I feel like he was kind of the,
but I think
the guy who set that up.
I kind of want to go down there. Sort of like, you know, going to spring training.
Yeah, you can go in the shootout.
Yeah. I'm not doing that.
Sounds pretty big. You could probably sit in for,
I could probably like hang out there for a little while until it got serious.
Yeah. Maybe the 200th guy in the baseline. Right.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Be good.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there is something to be said. I mean, it's interesting, you know, looking at already how many races have happened on the mountain bike UCI calendar. You know, there's something to be said for spending some time in Arizona in the sun, just getting some good training in instead of feeling like you have to go to Cyprus or go to Greece or, you know, whatever to try and get training miles, but also try to bank some points. I mean, that's a much more stressful existence. And
yeah, because, you know, we've already started racing there. Anton Cooper just
coming Spain down with this past weekend.
with a win this past weekend. And we are, I mean, we're right there. We're 2 weeks away from the first HC UCI race in Benelli in California, 2 weekends from now. So that's, I think, you know, have the opportunity to be down there. So I'll be down there covering that race. And I think it's going to be, I think it's going to be big. I think we're going to see a lot of people down there for that one.
I think so.
Cool way to kick off the season.
Yeah. It's always a good way to start the year. And, What are your, you have any wild predictions for Benelli?
I'm really curious to see. I don't have any predictions. I don't even know what the start list,
I don't even think there is a start list yet.
It'll be interesting to see who shows up. But if you look who's around, I mean, I think a lot of the Cliff team's going to be there. I don't know what Trek's, schedule is looking like. You know, I'd love to see Kate Courtney there on the men's side. I think that we are going to be seeing a season-long battle between teammates with Blevins and Grotz. Looking, you know, we haven't really talked about the Bens for the American selection, but I think those are the top two in the country who are going to be
That's gonna be a real, I mean, I think a real battle.
Yeah, and it sort of begs the question for me, and I want to talk to those guys to see how it is. I mean, I think that Chris Blevins is definitely the Olympics or something that he is going for, but he's a young U23 racer now.
Mm-hmm.
The qualification for the U.S. is elites,
mm-hmm.
so I don't think he's gonna race Mount St. Anne Elite Worlds. That'd be kind of crazy. He was a silver medalist in the U23. He has an opportunity to win a world championship. Do you?
I mean, it's a terrible position to be in, right? You almost get forced. Your hand is almost forced if you can't use U23 results.
Unless you... The thing is that if you take the gamble that Grotz is not going to be up in, say, the top 10, top 20 and then you can go down. So then you continue to go farther down in the qualifications. And those are like the tryout events.
Mm-hmm.
So the World Championships and then also Nova Mesto.
But so if you're not going to race Elite Worlds, then you've got one shot.
Yeah, and it's only... But if nobody... I don't know, because eventually it gets down to other qualifications.
Mm-hmm.
And... you know, it back to our favorite phrase of like metal capable and things like that. And then you get down to that discretionary positions. And it's just, clearly demonstrated the ability to produce a medal winning result. I don't know what that means, but I think it's all at the elite level. So eventually, Blevins is going to have to race in elite races. Mm-hmm. I think. Tell me, internet, that I'm wrong on this, and I'll try to get the actual facts on this. But I think that's kind of where we're at. I mean, I know that's why I believe Evie Richards is not racing U23 this year.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully, she'll be back racing. She's just back on a bike for the first time this week, but she's still eligible to race U23, but she's going to race elites because she has a big battle. Her and Annie Last and are really the top two British riders looking for Olympic spots. So yeah, I don't know. That's such a tough one. I don't know what you do there.
I mean, I think really it begs the real question of, you know, what do we collectively, the royal we, you know, what do we do so that for 2024, the U.S. isn't in this position where you have riders chasing one spot? You know, what has to happen that the overall nation ranking is higher?
Yeah.
So that you can spread the wealth around a little bit more.
So here's what we got. If you win, if an American wins Nova Mesto, they are automatically, they take that spot. That's like number one.
Wins in which category?
Elite.
Okay.
UCI Elite World Cup number one cross country event Nova Mesto, check, will be nominated to the 2020 Olympic game, up to one athlete.
Okay.
Per gender. If quota slots remain after considering the preceding criteria, athlete per gender who wins the 2019 UCI Elite World Championship in Mount St. Anne will be nominated of the two. So Nova Mesto above Mount St. Anne, I guess just from where it is on the calendar.
Mm-hmm.
If nobody wins, so that's number one. Number two, number three is one athlete per gender who finishes in second through eighth at Nova Mesto. All right. So that's your third auto qualifier.
Mm-hmm.
And then your fourth auto qualifier is second through eighth at World Championships in Mount St. Anne. Here's where it comes interesting, and maybe I'm answering my own question on Blevins. Number five, if quota slots remain per gender after considering the preceding criteria, then the highest ranked athlete per gender, provided they are in the top 10 overall in the final 2019 UCI World Cup overall ranking, will be nominated for the 2020 Olympic Games team. Just looking historically, I mean, Leah maybe in the past would have been up there.
Mm-hmm.
Not as good season last year, but once she was disappointed, but still getting top 20s.
Yep.
And then you'll have Kate Courtney, who I think is probably your best bet at meeting one of these top five criteria, especially going down to the top 10 in the world by the time we get.
Mm-hmm.
to the end of, yeah, up to the Olympic Games. So if there are spots left after, if nobody meets any of those,
then we're in the nebulous gray area.
Yes. Maybe nominated to the 2020 Olympic Games team from the long team by the USA Cycling National Team Coach and approved by the USA Selection Committee following discretionary criteria described in Section 2. So then that is truly where we come down to just this medal capable. Winning a medal within the last 24 months at a UCI World Cup or World Championship. And that's what I was saying. That's where Kate Courtney gets in as discretionary.
And Blevins, medal at a World Cup, right?
Yeah, it does not say elite there. Beating previous year's Worlds or Olympic medalists or current top UCI world ranking athletes in international competition on multiple occasions in the 12 months. So that's the other one. So, and after that, then you get to B, which is the future medal capable athletes, which gets grayer and more nebulous.
I hate to sound like a total cynic.
Yes.
But from a realistic perspective,
I mean, here it is. This is Blevins. B, bullet point two, winning medals at U23 World Championship in the last 24 months.
Yeah. But I mean, from a totally cynical perspective, I mean, the whole first half of these criteria are wildly optimistic.
I don't think that's cynical at all.
And
I think that's where we're at.
I mean, I think that looking now, the snapshot now of elite level, on the larger, wider spectrum, elite level American mountain bikers, Kate Courtney being the exception.
Right. She's the one person who's proven it.
I mean, they should almost flip the criteria. Section 2 should move up. Section 1 should move down.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, not that you shouldn't have these things for people to aspire to, but it's almost, I mean, I think you're right. I mean, the way it reads now, assuming that no one gets any of these results, it's going to be Kate Courtney and Chris Blevins.
Here's
assuming they want to go, but you know, I mean, I just feel like it happens too many times that these criteria get put out there and then it's like everything is set up for there to be controversy because it's not clear and or the automatic qualifier criteria are wildly optimistic and in many instances not attainable.
But so far...
So I'm ready to be attacked for that.
No.
Not by you, Bill.
Yeah, I'm going to groove one down.
By your loyal listeners.
I'm going to groove one down in the middle to you. So then I think both of us agree that despite the wild optimism, what I have read so far is objective.
Mm-hmm.
We can see what you need to do to make the team.
Mm-hmm.
Are you ready for C under discretionary? Oh, God. Here's where it all, I'm sorry, USA Cycling, actually, yeah, this is where it kind of falls apart. The catch-all. Okay. C, best predicted finish.
I'm sorry?
Best predicted finish. If positions for the team remain open after the application of all automatic selection and discretionary selection principles A and B above, the things that you said are wildly optimistic, or falling down to best predicted finish, the USA Cycling Selection Committee may choose the athlete or athletes who are most likely to finish the highest in the event based on the data below in the data to support discretionary selection section. Validatable and credible performance data such as times on courses or portions of courses of similar length or course profile and or in similar environmental conditions to the stop laughing event being selected for choosing between two athletes within a selection category, medal capable, future medal capable, or best predicted finish, data may include any or all the following: race results and top international competition, race results in top domestic competition, head-to-head competition. So cross results, I think, is what
we're... Is there a link to upload like your power data and
I think
Zwift
this is,
results?
This is, I think that you can... Here are the two things that we have learned from today's episode.
That the last part was drafted after they announced the partnership with Bike Reg.
No, better than that. You can follow the same system to A, make the Olympic team, B, be eligible for insurance through Health IQ.
Perfect. Fantastic. I hope you didn't spoil it, that's the presenting sponsor of the national team in 2019.
I think it should be.
Yeah.
I think it should be. Yeah.
Yeah, that's...
So...
I mean, I get it. I mean, you want to send the best athletes you have.
Yes. We are being hard on this, and they are in an impossible situation, especially since it's not the Swiss team last Olympics where we're talking about where everybody's going to meet all of those criteria, and it's just like they're going to beat each other to the death to see who's going to be at the top.
In the defense,
yeah,
of you know USAC or any national federation that has to come up with these criteria. I mean, just think about when Peter Sagan was like, "I'm going to race." The Olympics?
Yeah.
He wasn't a shoe-in.
No.
I mean, for selection from Slovakia, he wasn't assured a spot just because he's Peter Sagan.
Yeah. I mean, I was wrong when I said 37. I think it's only 30 in the field.
I mean, it's crazy because you look at the field sizes at World Cups and they're huge.
Yeah.
I mean, so, 30 is like you're going back. You can't even fill up four rows.
Right. And the thing that, like, what? Matthew Vanderpool is doing right now is assuring that the Netherlands have a spot.
Yeah. Whether it's him or not.
Right. He's basically carrying the load for that. I'm sure he'll fill that spot, but that's part of the gig now. He's not in there. I don't know what other Dutch riders are doing anything that they're going to push them in. They probably would, but you know.
So in, you know, May 2020, we'll be sitting here having a discussion about whether or not Vanderpool is going to win the Olympic road race and the mountain bike race at the same Olympics, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
What I'm waiting for with him, because he keeps hinting at it, and I'm just waiting for it to happen, is that he seems like he is so itching to race downhill. And that's going to be the thing. The thing actually, you know, you think about it with him, especially with his skills, if he has, you know, and who knows, if he showed that acumen where he could handle those downhill sections, think about him on an enduro course. It'd just be insane.
Hmm.
Something tells me he won't make the same money he's making now, but hey, just something else to add for him.
Yeah, that's okay.
Yeah.
I mean, if all else fails, they're going to have break dancing at the Olympics. So he seems like a pretty fit and flexible guy. He'd probably be good at that.
Yeah. Yeah. And they could bring back Kevin Powell's, but lay down some beats. Bwah. Right. And on that note,
we're out of here.
I think we've done it. I'm not sure what we did, but that was a fun conversation. We're going to have to do this more, Taylor.
Yeah, that was good.
Yeah. And after you finish downloading and subscribing and going to Apple Podcasts and rating and with 5 stars and leaving us a review, then head over to wideanglepodium.com. Check out all of the other shows that are available there and subscribe to those and check them out. We got a lot of good stuff going on. I know that the super rookie and Spencer and little guy are all excited about road season starting. So definitely give them a listen because definitely not you could give them a lesson. That was a good Freudian slip for sure. Yeah, you got a lot to learn about everything, but no, that show is awesome. Check it out. What one I, really want you all to give a listen to Aisha McGowan was on the Gravel Lot, and that's a good get. I'm jealous. I want to talk to her as well. She's an awesome guest and one to check out. So listen to the Gravel Lot, Consummate Athlete. Oh, here's one I need to check out, Taylor. It's How to Be a Happy Runner. So
when you find out, let me know.
I will definitely let you know.
I'm happy when I think that going for a run is a good idea.
Yeah.
And the happiness very quickly subsides when I wake up the next morning.
I know how that goes. One that's not on the list here, but now that you're here, we can just continue this wave and we'll get Elliot on the horn.
Mm.
And we had some plans for another Kids Don't Follow that I want to follow through on.
Yeah.
So in the
meantime,
yes.
We have 1 month of underground bicycle racing.
Oh yeah,
to focus on. Well, not to focus on, but you know.
Yeah, if you are, I'm not even going to say in the Mid-Atlantic. If you are anywhere, because we moved this so people can. This is a destination race now.
Yeah.
Crosshairs Garage Races.
You ask, we delivered
on Saturdays every March. Go to bikereg.com/crosshairsgarageraces, and you can register. And it's the best party you're going to find underground racing bikes. We got some awesome sponsors this year. Just talked to my friends over at Chrome. They're going to be sending us swag again. Trek is stepping up. They're doing our neutral support. Also going to have swag and gift certificates and a little party tent set up on there, which is going to be awesome. We have our new friends at Amazon who are sponsoring part of the event as well. So really, really, really starting to step it up. S Shape, my new favorite design firm. They are a sponsor.
If you work in a soulless office that needs a refresh.
Yeah. For sure.
They're your people.
So it's good. Food, beer, bike racing.
And the best part,
yes.
It's forecast to rain on Saturday.
Ugh.
But not in the garage.
Not in the garage.
It's going to be dry.
Bring a sweater, you'll be fine.
Yeah, it's going to be dry. It's going to be awesome. Good times, fun, you know, low stress. It's a great It's a great place for folks who've never raced before. You want to get out. You want to see what it's about. It's a super welcoming atmosphere. There's a race for you. You want to come out and you want to dial in your no break cornering for the Mid-Atlantic crit season. We got that race for you too. So there's something for everybody.
Yeah. And if you're heading out for the National Bike Summit, also in Crystal City,
mm-hmm.
also in March. So mm-hmm. you can just seamlessly go to the summit and then come out for a day of racing.
Yeah.
Taylor, you have a choice here. If you want to tell people where to get a hold of you on social media, you can do that. Or in the alternative, you can tell them just some other cool Instagram or Twitter feed to follow.
Mm. Wow, that's that's a good one.
I would say follow Taylor on Instagram so you can see pictures of his new dog.
Oh, that's true. He's very adorable.
Yeah. So yeah. That's just J. Taylor Jones, right?
J. Taylor Jones.
Yeah.
I will make one suggestion.
Yeah.
If you are like me and are a cycling nerd and love the history of the sport, especially, you know, road cycling, cyclocross from, you know, all the way back, whatever, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, if you're into that kind of stuff, there's some great folks on Instagram who post, you know, historic photos, video, etc. One that I found recently, I have no connection to this person, I don't know them, I found the account, and it's really great, and it's at The Welgen, so like Belgian but with a W.
Oh, nice.
Really cool, really good content. If you like, you know, you want to see video of Devlamic, Merckx, Freddie Martins, you know, kind of that era, you know, Greg LeMond, whatever, Eno, or back further, Gimondi, Kopi, whatever. That stuff's there. Really cool. I would say check it out. Totally worth it.
Fantastic. You can follow me at CX Hairs. Also follow Garage Races on Instagram. We've been loading up that account with some cool content, and we'll continue going forward. If you want to get a hold of me or the show, you can do that at feedback@cxhairs.com. Check out all of the content over at cxhairs.com. We got a lot of good stuff ending up the cyclocross season from Drew Giuliano and his derp columns and everything else going on over there. And yeah, thanks, cyclocross friends. We'll see you next time.